Good morning, Omo. How are you this morning?
Very well, Grant. Thank you very much.
What's been bothering you over the weekend?
like a lot of people up and down New Zealand, the weather isn't very flash.
I was going to say, how's the weather where you were?
Pretty average, mate. You know, yeah. A lot of rain and wind and so on, as it is over most of the country at the moment. But I've actually been thinking about what we talked about last week, you know, weather manipulation and, you know, the chemtrails we touched on and that sort of stuff. And when you look at it, you know, we're often our view or our opinion on what's happening is kind of short-sighted. We don't see things in a bigger perspective. And as we talked about last week, you know, we really need to take an evidence-based approach to pretty much everything. So the recent terrible floods down in, you know, Hawke's Bay, and of course we had them in Auckland. I mean, well, you build a massive swimming pool, you know, with lots of bitumen, and you put concrete walls around it, and then you wonder why it fills up when it rains, you know, so which is a bit, you know, there's questions to be asked there.
That's right. All my troughs are overflowing.
Yeah, but, you know, weather events have happened from time immemorial. I was just trolling YouTube, and I came across a video on these 1974 floods in Brisbane, and they were absolutely catastrophic, you know, and that was, you know, almost citywide. And we look at what happened in Wairoa and Hawke's Bay and so on, and, you know, it's terrible what's happened to these people, and you know, our hearts go out to them. But then you ask the question, then are we building on a floodplain? And when you think about, say, in history, we look back, you know, the Nile is one of the most, what do they call it, the cradle of mankind sort kind of thing. And it is, you know, incredibly fertile. And the people that lived there, they didn't build houses on the floodplains. What they did was they grew annual crops. They didn't grow long-term crops. They grew stuff that, you know, if it got washed away, then it didn't matter that I have a crop the next year. So maybe we need to rethink some of the decisions we make about where we choose to live. But anyway, yeah, it was just a general observation. You know, the weather is always very popular as a topic of conversation, as is, of course, money. And we've just had the budget.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, wow. What do you think they're spending our money on the right things?
I'll be completely honest. I didn't even bother turning it on. there's very little that we can do to change what these politicians are doing. But when and to my my view, it to me appears to me that all they're doing is setting up for yet another election. They're trying to buy votes, you know, pork barreling, call it what you like. But they're not spending the money in ways, I think, that the general man in the street, if I can say that, would want their money spent, our taxes spent. They're actually spending it on what will keep them in, what they think will keep them in power, what will buy votes. And that comes down to a really, you know, one of the quintessential things of our society. We all pay taxes, and I talk to my children about this, have done for a long time. We contribute part of our wealth, part of our work, our assets, to the good of the whole community, you know, and we put that in a centralized place so that a group of people that we hopefully can trust, we elect them or whatever, will disperse or spend that money in ways that will benefit the society. Things like, you know, the stuff that we need to run a society, a complex infrastructure, we need roads, we need bridges, healthcare. Sometimes some of the members of our society are unfortunate, you know, they have issues these days, unemployment or an accident. And so as a society, we contribute part of our wealth to supporting those people. And that's the sort of things that it should be spent on. And I guess what it condenses to is that we need to ask the question, are our funds, is our work, our assets that we contribute, is it being used in the way that we, the majority, would want it to do so? That's, I think, a question that really needs to be answered, because my opinion is, of course, it's not. You know, they're spending it on all this other stuff that's going to buy them votes. It's not being spent. And look at the state of the roads in New Zealand and the infrastructure. And, I mean, even, you know, you look at Hawke's Bay, you know, what has been done, it's all vanished into people's memory. But there are people still living in, you know, tents inside what's left of the shell of their houses without heating and everything else. And yet it's disappeared from the consciousness. Why is that not being addressed?
And with the winter coming on, it's going to be dreadful for those people.
Horrendous, absolutely horrendous, you know. But of course, now it's the next current thing, or the next shiny thing, or as the Americans say, what do they say? They go, squirrel, you know. This is the latest thing to see, and so people's attention is diverted. But what I was trying to touch on was that I don't believe that our money, our wealth, is being spent in the ways that the general the general populace would want it to be done.
I agree with all those things, like health and education. They're not doing it. Look at health; health is a shambles, and that to me is engineered. getting people, getting the doctors, though they're still mandated out of job, the nurses and doctors, the good ones.
Not just the good ones, but the ones that, you know, it's not saying good or bad or otherwise.
I reckon the good ones are the ones that refuse the vaccine, the mRNA experimental jab.
They certainly made an informed choice.
What's left are state doctors, not great doctors. If they were great, they would have said no.
Well,
enough of them.
I'm not 100% sure that that's the case.
Am I too tough?
I think the majority of people that work in healthcare, are genuinely good people. Whether people made one decision or another is up to them individually. But the thing is that some people made what we now know was an informed choice in the right direction, and they're still being penalised for it. And of course, the rest of our society is being penalised because we don't have the doctors, we don't have the nurses. You look everywhere; there are still people, who would want to return to work who are still not allowed to because of these, vaccine policies that they have, but particularly in the health industry.
Yeah, I just think it's curious to me that they've still got mandates on with health professionals, and they know that that masks don't work. The Cochrane report reveals that masks are rubbish, and a lot of doctors, like the ones in my practice, there's only one out of the three that's remained there taking patients. The other two said, I'm not getting that jab, and I'm not wearing a mask. So they stayed away, and he's run off his feet. Good on them.
Yeah.
That's what I say. Good on them.
It's curious. As I'm in the same boat.
Well, it's curious to me that they still have mandates on. It's as though they're engineering a health system to fail.
Blind Freddy can see that the mRNA vaccines were neither safe nor effective. The evidence is everywhere around you. I refer to the it's Pfizer data. And this is, again, the evidence-based approach.
Yeah.
I go and read the source data because we're meant to have informed debate and discourse, but very rarely do you see the pro-vaxxers offering up studies that say it is safe and effective, the counter-narrative from Pfizer itself. They talk about these terrible, terrible adverse effects of it.
Yeah.
It's just, it's appalling. And the data is there, but a lot of people are turning their faces away. And I don't understand that. That, to me, is... it indicates perhaps cognitive dissonance, that we talked about, that mental model not able to reconcile with what you're actually seeing. I don't know if it's emotional involvement or investment that they're really afraid, because a lot of people now are going, oh my God, I've had a couple of these shots, am I going to fall over with a heart attack?
Yeah.
And again, that's part of the division that's been driven into our society,
which is
not a good thing.
For radio announcers, we've lost three in the last week. They're not that old.
Oh, crikey.
I love the oldest of 75, Barry Jenkin. He's a very well-known radio jock in New Zealand, and he passed away last week. And then who did we have before then? It was Muzza, Murray Ingalls.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
Oh, I don't know. You've got to sort of think, have they been jabbed? There's certainly the amount of people, there's a lot more dying now than there were. The stats are up.
Absolutely, no question.
Do they call that now, the overall death?
Excess mortality.
Yep, it's huge.
So it takes a projection of the average death rates across, multiple years, and then they have a look at what the average mortality would be, and it's clear, it's very clear now from New Zealand's official data, government data, that the excess mortality, there are more people dying now than there were during COVID, and we've got to ask why.
And some changed? People,
some people say, it's all the cancer diagnoses that weren't made and everything else. I don't really accept that.
Some doctors are saying that the mRNA vaccine, I hate calling it that, the jab, excites cancers, inflames them.
Sort of oncologists talking about turbo cancers and things now. And again, we've got to have hard evidence. The problem is that I don't believe that the vested interests are giving us the truth.
No.
And it's like studies. They say, this study shows this. When you already know what result you want, then scientists can skew a study in any particular direction. And this is why we've got to have the informed debate between the pros and the antis on anything. But and health is a big thing. And I think we got onto that through just talking about the disbursement of how our tax is spent, and that's something I would like to talk about a little bit, would be, sort of what is wealth, because that's what drives all of us, I guess.
Yeah.
And why do we go to get it, and the bottom line is, and I look to nature for just about the answers to just about everything.
Mm-hmm.
And in nature, we our primary drive is to reproduce, is to find a mate and to and have children and see them successful in their lives. And this is a fundamental driver throughout nature, part of what I believe is natural selection, you know. And so we want to provide for our children as best we can. And, of course, that drive to have as many children as we possibly can. And we still see this in the undeveloped world, you know, they have very large families because of infant form mortality. But it also provides a very more diverse genetic offspring, so that should the environment change, there's a good chance that several of your children will survive and pass on the genetic line. And so we want to have as many children as we can. But to do that, we've got to be able to feed them and protect them. And that's why we have, in nature, we have a drive, a very basic drive to acquire assets and resources so that we can have more children, you know, and we can provide for them and care for them and protect them.
And security, so that's kind of, for your family.
Absolutely, yeah. But that drive, that fundamental drive in the limbic system, you know, right back in 100,000 years ago, is very, very strong. And nature has always provided limits on us, I believe, to restrain that, so that no one individual or small group of individuals could control too much or be too dominant. And the big brain experiment, humans, gave us mastery of technology. And so for the first guy that figured out to use a digging stick instead of his hand to make a furrow and plant seeds and so on, he had an advantage. And the first guy to have a tractor, when his mates were using horses, he had an advantage. And so he could have more wealth. He could grow more wheat. He could trade or provide for more children and so on. And as a result, his children were more numerous. His genetic line became more dominant. And this is a process of natural selection, but just using technology. The problem is with technology is that as it develops, so a smaller and smaller group have more and more control of the technology, to where we arrive effectively where we are today over generations, where a very, very small group controls so much of the technology of the world. When we're talking about, you know, the Facebooks, the Googles and so on, and their influence over the rest of us is just enormous, you know. Yeah, so we're all driven to acquire these assets, you know, and to have what we call wealth. And we really need to think about what are they, and they're actually the things that we can use. So assets and your wealth is what you can build, what you can make, what you know, your skills, your knowledge, your experience that you can share in a community. And we then developed a complex society where we work together in teams. I talked about a little bit about that last week. So nature has always provided limits on effectively the strength, you know, of all species, the strength of their arm, their ability to acquire and sequester assets for the benefit of their genetic offspring. And then with the advent of technology, with the big brain experiment, so we circumvented those limits. And it's been a continuing narrowing of focus or narrowing of control of technology that has allowed many a smaller and smaller group over generations to control more and more of the assets of the world. So normally nature would provide limits on it, but nevertheless, putting that aside, the technology and the monopolization of it, we developed these complex societies where with technology we were able to have an excess so that we could have something to trade. I've got a bit extra wheat, or I've got two cows instead of one, and so I can swap some milk for some wheat or some bacon or whatever. And so we had a barter type economy. And so that's the fundamentals, the exchange of wealth with other individuals who have got some to spare. And this is where we developed an economy. And people talk about a global economic collapse, which is upon us. I don't think it's, well, whether it's global or not, I don't know. But certainly our current financial system looks to be very, very shaky. But fundamentally, even if the US dollar or the whatever it is, you know, however it all goes, it collapses, there'll still be an economy. People will still be able to swap their wealth, their experience, their knowledge, their assets, the real things. What they won't be able to swap is the pieces of paper that someone gave them that they used to swap for, you know, those other assets. And that's when we talk about currencies and money, you know, the stuff in your wallet. A lot of people think it's money. It's not. It's, well, in my opinion, it's actually currency. You know, it's something that we use.
A promissory note, isn't it?
Yeah, a claim check on your wealth. And so if we talk about currency, you know, they've got there's a few basic principles, I guess. So if you want to have an IOU, if you want to call it an IOU-based system where you don't have to carry your pigs and your milk and your wheat, bags of wheat around with you to swap at the local market, we develop this system of currency, or money, people call it, where we could have something small and portable, and we could take that along, and someone would give us their wealth, what they've grown or built, in exchange for that, because they could then take that token and swap it with someone else. So the guts of it is that this currency has got to have a few basic characteristics. And the first one, of course, it's got to be trusted by both counterparties to an exchange. You know, people have got to be willing to accept it and use it. It's got to be one of the words is fungible. That's, you know, it's got to be if I can get a say I've got one gold coin, I can get a liter of milk for that here, and I can go to another village and I can get a liter of milk there.
What do you call it? Fungible. Days,
fungible. Yeah, it just means something has the same value in two places. You know, it's got to be durable. You know, if and this is why gold was such a good one in the early days. Gold was very much a standard of money because you could put it in your pocket and wash your jeans, and it came out and it was still a piece of gold. Whereas if you did that with a piece of paper with a number written on it, you've lost it. So it's not durable. It's got to be divisible. You've got to be able to make change. You know, if we're going to have an economy, you've got to be able to you know, sort of make change out of it. It's got to be a unit of account, which is just fairly self-explanatory. It's just got to it's got to be equal to a certain amount of stuff, if you know what I mean. But the big one is that it's got to be a store of value. So that, and that means that if I can have a piece of bacon now and I can have the same piece of bacon in a week or a year, then if I've got a piece of currency that would equal that piece of bacon now, I've got to be able to get that same piece of bacon for that piece of paper in a year. What I'm talking about here is, of course, inflation. And this is where we talk about two different types of currency. One is a commodity currency, which is you only have a certain number of pieces of paper that equal the assets that you have, or you have a fiat currency, which is a piece of paper that has no intrinsic value in itself. You're not guaranteed you can get it. Am I making sense, Grant?
The fiat, that's like the fix it again, Tony, sort of the Italian motor car, isn't it?
So exactly.
That's a concern, just calling it that for a start.
Absolutely, yeah. So the idea of, and the problem with, and when you look back in economic history, you know, there have been thousands of currencies issued by central authorities, you know, these governments or whatever. There's been thousands of currencies, and every one of them, every single one in history, it's value has eventually gone to zero. That is, you couldn't get anything for it. You can't get a pig, a cow, or a piece of bacon for it. And that is through the process of inflation. And what it is that the central issuing authority of every fiat currency ever existed has never been able to restrain themselves from creating more of that currency to do stuff that they want. So they've exceeded...
Print more money, is what you're saying? And that causes inflation.
Precisely, yes. Yeah. They print... Well, they don't print money, they print currency.
Yes.
And this is exactly what we've seen since it really started in 1997, then 2008. You know, that there is a big economic problems in the world through corruption or mismanagement of funds, whatever. We haven't even touched on banks yet. But governments saw fit to print currency to give people confidence, and that's the problem. That we talked about this, a fundamental characteristic of any currency to be valid, it has to be trusted by the people who are willing to exchange it, the counterparties. And if we then lose confidence in that currency, then it has zero value, because pieces of paper, you can't eat them. Well, you can, but they don't taste good. You can't sleep under them. You can't drive them. You know, they're not going to fix you. That it's not wealth. And the problem with these fiat currencies is that every issuing authority has always printed more to expand their empire effectively. The Romans did it. I mean, ancient Rome, you know, the coins that they had, each coin that passed through the treasury at tax time, they used to file a little bit off the edge, you know, and they'd take all those bits and pieces and they'd melt them down and they would amalgamate them with something, a metal in those days that wasn't worth as much. And so they effectively had more coins. They weighed less, but people didn't really notice. And in fact, if you look at our coins today, that's why they have those little grooves, those witness marks around the edge. It's to stop people filing a bit off the edge.
Oh, I didn't know that. Oh, that's really... Yeah. You're full of information, Nomo.
Well, and why do you think that the coins are coloured gold and silver?
Yeah.
Then there's
to give you an impression of wealth.
Because gold value is fundamental. And I'm not a gold bug by any means, but gold is is fundamental in our society, in history, as being money. So inflation is a paper that just keep print more and more and more. And an analogy I use is the difference between price and value, and I talk to kids about this, is that someone's got a cake for sale and you and your mate are at the counter and you've both got a piece of paper with a five written on it and you both really want the cake that this guy's got for sale, and so the price that guy will get will be five whatever's bazoobas from you or five bazoobas from the other fella. Now, inflation, somebody in the background comes around and slips another one of those pieces of paper in each of your pocket. So now you've got pieces of paper in your pocket. They say 10. And so what's the price of the cake that the guy's got for sale? It's going to be 10 bazoobas or whatever. But what's the value of the cake? You can only eat it once. This is the fundamental principle of inflation. And again, I try and do things, you know, reduce things to a simplistic analogy so that it's easier to understand. But that is what inflation is. It is the rise in prices to accept or to absorb circulating currency supply. Does that make sense to you?
You should be a university lecturer. You're very good.
I don't think so.
They would kick you out, though, because they wouldn't like you because you're not a leftist.
Because I'm not. I don't
They'd make your life hell.
Yeah. So, but anyway, so, you know, we've kind of covered the basics of currency and money and the wealth. But so what do we do with that? We want to protect it. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, well, I was just going to recap. So currency, it's got to be trustable, fungible, durable, divisible, going to be able to give change. It needs to be a unit of account.
Unit of account.
Yeah. It has to be a store of value. And there's two types. You said there's a commodity and there's the fiat. And we've got the fiat. The commodity would be like gold and silver, wouldn't it? And other commodities.
Or it can be the pieces of paper, as long as there's no more pieces of paper than there are assets to back it.
Being printed, exactly. Right. And so we don't have a gold backing.
Was it 1971, I think Richard Nixon temporarily, suspended the convertibility of gold into paper money. I think it was at $35 an ounce or something back then. And ever since then, they've just printed because they had a currency problem, a financial problem, and they just printed more to make people feel confident. And that's really good while it's circulating. But eventually inflation bites. And is there anyone in New Zealand that wouldn't, you know, ask the average person in the street, what do they think the current rate of inflation is? Do they think it's 6 or 8 or 10%, whatever the government admits?
It feels more than that.
Selected, bloody oath it does.
It feels like about 50%, if you ask me.
Absolutely.
It's gone like everything's doubled. So every fiat currency, you're saying, the value of it eventually goes to zero.
Because the issuing authority can't control the impulse to print to give them a temporary surge of, they would call it wealth, it's not, because it's hollow, to expand, you know, ostensibly to expand their empire, is the way some people put it, you know, but to do whatever, to make themselves feel better, to buy votes or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it's exactly what New Zealand did, along with all the other Western countries, you know, when COVID came, in 2008, they printed money, you know, they called it quantitative easing.
That's what they called it.
Blind Freddy. Blind Freddy could what was going to happen. You know?
That's great. Nuts.
And it now they're nuts. All jumping up and down. Sorry, go ahead.
So we've got our money in the bank.
Yes.
Now we've got a choice.
Do you?
Do we pull it out and put it under the pillow? Put it in the tin or something? Or do we invest it in something else? And if so, what? And it's got to be something that you can quickly, you know, trade with. Doesn't it?
Well, what, once again, that fundamental question, what is wealth? What are assets? Assets are things that you can eat, that you can drive, that you can sleep under, that keep the rain off, build things with, grow things with, you can survive with. That's what assets are. And so pieces of paper aren't, while everyone is happy to accept them, pieces of paper equal those assets. But if the value of those pieces of paper falls to zero, as we saw in everywhere like Weimar Germany, and we're seeing right now in New Zealand and the rest of the Western world, we're seeing prices go through the roof. This is simply inflation because they printed too much of it. But yeah, so, you know, you ask there, what do we do? Do we put it in the bank? Well, does anyone really believe that they've got wealth in the bank?
Well, I mean, I got a bit frightened last month and I drew it all out and reinvested it in other things.
Mm-hmm. Good.
So now if I need to go and pay a bill, I've got to go into the bank. I've got to sell something, take some cash in and then pay it online. Either that or get someone else to pay for it, and then I just give them the bartering with them, or give them some cash. So I don't know. We're going to have to start changing, aren't we? We can't just carry on with money in the bank. I used to have thousands, tens of thousands in the bank, and not worry about it. Mm-hmm. And then they put the willies up me. You know, my friends, Kevin McCracken from Starve the Beast. He said he keeps the most of the he's prepared to lose, that he's willing to lose in the bank. And he said people pay him sometimes using the bank account, and he just draws it out. And he basically is cash. He does firewood. He collects rice. He buys 5 and 10 kg bags of rice, so he stores that. And he's got massive amounts of firewood. That's an investment for him. Building materials, nails, screws, all sorts of things like that. And he sort of invests in his knowledge, really. So Kevin, he'll buy, like I said, he'll do firewood and stuff like that, and he'll just trade. So that's what he does. He has some cash. I think he has about $10,000 of cash just hidden around the place. And but other than that, anything else? Oh, and he puts it into gold. Gold. I think he has 20% gold and 80% silver, and he buys coins. That's what he does, and they're just slowly going up. So that's how he does it.
Yep.
So that's Kevin. So what do you reckon? It's just one man's opinion, isn't it?
It is absolutely only one man's opinion, and somewhat uninformed, I'm quite sure a lot of people would think.
I don't think so. You don't sound uninformed.
So, yeah, we talk about, you just referred to people amassing assets that they can use or they can trade, and that's one of the important things that determines value of anything is can you, as I said, eat it, sleep under it, and so on. But it's also something you have that might have value is if someone else wants it and is willing to exchange something they've got for it. And this is again the fundamentals of money, so assets are things that we want to use, that we use, or that we can exchange with someone else for what they can build or they can make.
So that brings me on to my next question. What about the banks? Where do you see them? How do they fit in?
Can I just go back a little bit and we talk about what the internet actually means? Because, you and I are using this wonderful, wonderful development of technology. And all technologies are inherently neither good nor evil. It's always down to the use to which the human hand puts them from the philosophical point of view. But we developed this thing called the internet. But the internet is not some marvel sitting up in the clouds or anything else. It's simply an electronic way of transferring information, and it does so as an analog or a direct parallel to the way that we have done transferred or transacted information forever. In the old days, we'd write a letter, we'd write a person-to-person communication, we'd write it out on a piece of paper, and we'd put it in an envelope and a stamp and all that sort of nonsense, and you'd put it in a bag, and it'd go to that person on the other side of the world. What a wonderful use of technology. What a wonderful, use of our brain to enable that information exchange, writing books, going back to the very first Gutenberg presses and so on. Mm. We'd write a book, and it was all written out, and then it would be printed, and it could be shared. We could transact the information. The internet simply provided us with the development of the technology, the TCP/IP transfer control protocol and internet protocol, gave us the capability to transfer information between individuals and groups in exactly the same way. But it's not invented anything new. It's just give us an instantaneous way of doing that, of transacting information, be it a book, a television show, a talk like we're having, a letter or whatever. And then people say, well, why didn't we do that with money, with finance, with currency? And that was a fundamental problem that was solved a little while ago. It was called the double spend problem. It's one of the things that Satoshi Nakamoto solved. So if I take a photo on my phone and I send it to you via email, how many copies of that photo are there then, Grant? Well, there's a couple, yeah.
And or at in least fact, two, anyway.
Yeah, and in fact, every hard drive it goes through on a server or a router or whatever, there'll be a copy there as well.
Yeah.
Now, if that was the case with money, say, let's just talk about currency as money, okay? If I take out a $5 bill, when you give me the cat or whatever you're selling me, or a liter of milk, and I give you the $5 bill, that $5 bill changes hands from mine to yours. It can't be in both places at once, can it?
No.
So there's only one copy of that $5 bill ever. That's why internet money didn't work until the advent of effectively Bitcoin. So internet money's been talked about for a long time. It's called the double spend problem. Yep, because using the internet, you could send the same token in two directions at once. That would, of course, be insanely inflationary. A lot of people take advantage of it. It wouldn't work. So that was one of the fundamental stumbling blocks why we didn't have an internet of money or an internet of value, if we can call it that, previously. Now, 2008, global financial crisis, people's copies of the ledgers were interfered with, shall we say, bailouts and bail-ins, lots of bad stuff. And someone finally sat down and decided to solve these sorts of problems. And they did so The aim was to create a decentralized ledger, a ledger like the little man in the bank had, but where there were multiple copies all over the world that had to be in agreement about what was a valid transaction. Does that make sense?
Yep,
I'm trying to cover the fundamentals. Yep. Okay.
Yeah. Decentralized. So, yep.
Decentralized. Yeah. Mm. And that meant that it was that no one individual or group could say, no, you don't have $20 on the ledger anymore, because a blockchain is just a ledger which is up in the cloud, effectively an internet ledger. It's no different to one on your computer. The blockchain records every transaction that is ever made, but a transaction doesn't get to be a valid transaction until a majority or a consensus of the validators or the copies of the ledger around the world agree that that's a valid transaction. But once they do, it becomes a valid transaction in that block of data, and it remains that way forever and ever and ever.
Mm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it sounds safe. Look, that sounds really safe, doesn't it?
Well, the prime aim of it was developed as a reaction to the global financial crisis of 2008, where money was just printed into oblivion, which is what we're facing now.
Is blockchain that new? It's 2008, just after that it kicked off.
Oh, goodness, no. The concept has been around for a long time. Some of the granddads of the internet, David Chaum, C-H-A-U-M, I think it is. You know, people have talked about internet of money, but there were a couple of stumbling blocks to it right from the very start. And people, you know, and I try to talk to people about cryptocurrency and how it can answer some of the problems that we've got with the financial system.
Mm.
And people go, oh, but it's so complex, it's too technical. And so you remember, I'm sure, Grant, when credit cards first arrived, yeah?
Mm, yeah. Everyone thought it was the mark of the beast.
Absolutely. And did anyone understand how they worked?
Not really.
Not really.
No.
But they became ubiquitous, and you know, everyone had one. And then, and same with debit cards. Do people know how it works? No. So cryptocurrency, this idea of a distributed ledger, means you've got to have some sort of a recording system that's individual to you. And to do that, we needed to use cryptography. It doesn't really matter if it's called public key cryptography. And we create on the ledger, so you can log in the same way, and this is the analogy I often draw between your debit card, so your bank account. You have two numbers for your account. You have your account number, which is your publicly known number, isn't it? And anyone that's got that number could send funds or numbers to your account on the ledger. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yep. But who can send money or numbers from that ledger? What have they got to have? They've got to have the other number that exists, and that is your, in these days, your PIN number. Yep, your personal identification number. Yep.
Right. So only you've got that.
That's correct. Mm. Yeah, absolutely. You've got control of that. So in cryptography or in cryptocurrency, we have this huge, enormous ledger that can record all these transactions, and on every copy of that ledger, you have an individual entry or a page, you could say, if you want to use the paper analogy. And that page has two numbers. It has a public key and a private key. Now, in the case of cryptocurrency, and we won't go into the cryptography side of it, but they're very big numbers and they're mathematically linked. And when we create this is called a key pair, we first, using some randomness, we create a really long number that's called the private key. And from that, we do some mathematical stuff using what we call one-way mathematical functions to create the public key. So it doesn't matter how it works. You don't need to really know. The idea is, using cryptocurrency, you have two numbers to control your wallet. And the person that has control of the private key, a key pair or wallet, you have control of the private key. And as long as you do, no one can transact on that account, on that page, that wallet, on the ledger, on the blockchain, without controlling that, without that private key.
You think we'd be better off learning more about the cryptocurrency and the blockchain and public and private keys and that sort of thing and getting a wallet? You think we'd be more... Surely, what if the company goes broke? That's, you know, you've got this wallet being held by some company, and then he goes tits up. Then what?
Well, that's the whole idea of decentralization. There is no one entity that you rely on. So
what do you call that, a decentralized wallet?
A decentralized ledger. So a ledger is like the big book in the bank. Yep. Think about the original bank. He has a
double
big book
sort of
in
thing.
The bank.
Yep.
And in that book are lots and lots of pages, in this case potentially billions, and every person, every wallet, every key pair has a page in there. Okay, and but only the person with the private key can transfer away from that page. Anyone with the public key, with your bank account number effectively, can send funds to it. But only the person that has the private key, control of the private keys, can send funds away from that account.
Is there any way that a government, would be it rogue or whatever, could stop you transferring funds from one to another using this system, this wallet?
All right. Okay, so I talked about the characteristics or the attributes of money. So the same with crypto. It's got to be, if a crypto is going to be a properly formed crypto in the way that cryptocurrency was meant to be, it's got to be trustless, permissionless. That means no one can stop you. Yeah, disintermediated is another word for that no one can approve. Because if I say in the traditional banking system, using the BNZ or the ASB or whatever you want, I want to send you some funds through our online banking, could anyone stop that, do you think?
Certainly could.
They certainly can.
The police could stop them. Anyone could. The government, anybody. Anyone, Jacinda could have. They did. Up in Canada, he stopped funds for people, the truckers.
Absolutely.
Well, it was froze their bank accounts.
It was the banks that did that.
Billy Tekihika, he had his account frozen.
Absolutely. Yep. And this is the problem with a centralized ledger, that people with the power to control our financial transactions sometimes misuse that power. Again, the technology itself is neither good nor bad, evil or whatever, malicious, you know. It's just that the people, the human hand that wields the technology, needs to be able to be trusted. And sometimes, and we've seen this, it's exactly what you've said, they can't be trusted.
And that's the first problem with the currency that we've got today is that it can't be trusted. The last two, 3 years have proven that is not a trustworthy way to invest your, what do you call it?
Your wealth,
yeah.
You're quite right. You're quite right. And so
right. We've got to get out quick.
Well, yeah. Well, we could clean it up. We could just, you know, we could have some honest politicians and people in power that wouldn't abuse the power of a centralized ledger. But unfortunately, that's just not in human nature. They can't help themselves.
No.
They're out to acquire as many assets and control of stuff as they can, and so they'll continue to abuse that. And this is why Satoshi Nakamoto, whoever solved these problems, for any new technology to come into widespread use, the first thing you've got to do is you've got to have the technology. So when we talk about this public key cryptography, I know it's a bit of an involved and brain-hurting subject, but the first thing we need to do was have the mathematics solved, okay, so that this system would work. And that was done, God's truth, in the late 80s, 90s, and so on, you know. So that the mathematics for this public key cryptography was complete. And it was Satoshi Nakamoto that first took it and applied it into a system, a protocol that allowed what we're talking about, this secure blockchain, disintermediated, permissionless transfer of numbers from one wallet on a ledger to another using that decentralized ledger. Does that make sense so far?
It does. But what I'm finding is that when I looked into it, they wanted to have all this personal information about you. They wanted to know, you know, all your IRD stuff, and you know, and they wanted a scan of your face and your passport and all your driver's license and all that. The companies that you, when you get a wallet, if you want a wallet to be able to trade in Bitcoin.
No, goodness. Okay. No. So, all
it's
right.
It's different.
So, yeah. No, you don't need a. What you're talking about is creating an exchange. All right. So, you're creating an account at an exchange, because what you're talking about now is on-ramping your wealth, your financial wealth, into crypto to be able to buy. In the same way that if you wanted to buy a share in a company, you have to have an account at a stock exchange. You know, you want to buy shares.
It just seems like they could fold and then you'd lose everything. And then, you know, I don't like them having all this information. What's the point of having a cryptocurrency if it's all going to be open to whoever to look at it?
You're talking about two different things.
Am I?
You create, So sitting at your computer,
explain things.
Sitting at your computer, you can use some software to create a cryptocurrency, a key pair on a particular blockchain, and there's lots of them.
My own cryptocurrency.
You can create a wallet, an account, on a particular blockchain,
and that's a decentralized wallet. Only I can use it.
A decentralized blockchain, a decentralized ledger, and you have one wallet. you have one key pair that accesses on that. So you think about, once again, use that the physical world, that, that example of having the ledger, the big book, and you have one page in there, and only you can take stuff out of that page.
Right.
So you can create a key pair, or it's commonly called a wallet, on a blockchain, and there's lots of them. I know somewhere near 20,000 different cryptocurrencies these days, I believe, and that's another story. But you can create a wallet on any particular blockchain, and you control that from your computer. What you're talking about is giving all your ID and so on is all to do with the anti-money laundering and know your client type stuff that governments impose on banks and stock exchanges. If you want to have an account at a stock exchange so that you can go and buy shares, then you've got to prove who you are and that you're not money laundering and all the rest of it. In the same way that cryptocurrency exchanges that were formed with the advent of crypto, the government has said to them that if you're going to sell cryptocurrency to people in exchange for cash or for you know, credit card transactions or whatever, then you need to go through this KYC stuff. So they're quite separate things.
KYC.
Know your client.
Oh, yeah.
This is you know, sort of these sorts of terms were generated, I think it was probably back in the 90s, early 90s, with what they called an international group called the Financial Action Task Force, the FATF, and they introduced international regulations to try and stop money laundering, to stop organized crime, you know, and et cetera, et cetera. So these KYC and AML, they're called restrictions, were applied to cryptocurrency exchanges. And yes, to have an account there, to be able to send them your cash via your banking website, and then to get cryptocurrency deposited to your wallet on that ledger, you had to prove who you were. But they're two quite separate things. Once you've bought that crypto from them and they send it to your account, to your wallet on the ledger, then no one can shift it from there unless they control the private key. And that's why one of the most famous sayings in cryptocurrency is not your keys, not your crypto. And that means that if I say send $10 to a particular cryptocurrency exchange to buy Bitcoin or whatever, then I will shift that from that exchange straight away to my wallet on the blockchain. Okay? It takes it out of their control.
You use this a lot, don't you? This is how you do it. You don't bother with large amounts of money in bank accounts, large amounts of fiat currency.
Hang on, how do I talk about that? Sorry, I've got to think about that. I was going to say my current financial circumstances don't allow me to. But yes, I started investing crypto quite a long time ago, you know, in the early 2012, 2013 sort of thing, because I have an interest in this sort of stuff.
Yeah, I got interested in it, but it was a bit hard for me. I just sort of got left behind. And
I had the same problem. I listened to a podcast back in, it was about 2012, about Bitcoin, and I downloaded the software. Yep. And I tried to install it. It was about 2 a.m. and I couldn't get it to run on the machine that I had at the time. And so I gave up in disgust. And I kind of left it lie. And the chap who ran the podcast, his name was Steve Gibson. He's one of the grandfathers of the internet, the security guru, been around forever.
Steve Gibson.
He's one of the granddads of the internet. He was at MIT with Steve Jobs and Bill Gates and so on.
Oh, yeah.
So he's been around a long time. He has a great podcast called Security Now. And he talked about this the advent of this application of cryptography into cryptocurrency. And so the following week, I listened to the podcast, and he'd run this client, the Bitcoin client, on his little machine. And he'd minted, I think it was 50 Bitcoins effectively overnight, you know. And because they were worth nothing, fraction of a cent then, it was just an interesting note in the podcast, and we went on. Well, come 2017, the host of the podcast asked him, well, how are you feeling about those 50 Bitcoins? And of course, he had to confess up and say he'd lost a hard drive. So he'd lost control of the private key. And so even though he had 50 Bitcoins, which were then worth, it was $20,000 or something, you know, it was a lot of money.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was $1 million, but he didn't have access to it. And there's lots of stories about that. So this is this idea of not your keys, not your crypto. But it's the same with your cash. We put money in the bank because we don't want to have all of our assets in one place at home where we could possibly, you know, the house could burn down or we could lose it or whatever. The same with crypto.
So what do you do to secure that without risking it to a third party, that information? How do you secure it?
Okay, so when we generate, when we create, we've got the fundamental understanding that a blockchain is a distributed ledger that has copies or nodes, copies of the ledger all around the world. It's the same as a paper ledger that's instantaneously copied to lots of safe, secure, individual, anonymized places around the world. Yeah, mm-hmm. We create a wallet on that, which is a key pair. And then it was only the person who has the private key that can transact or can send funds or numbers from that wallet to another one on the blockchain. Mm. Have I made that fairly clear?
Yeah, that's good.
Okay, so in the process of creating that key pair, we generate a set of some clues of some kind, and these days they're called a seed phrase, and they come from a big long list, mainly the. It's called the BIP39 list. It's 2,048 individual words that are combined in a random way, and you write those words down because those words...
Seed phrase, is that S-E-D-E or S-E-E-D?
No, S-E-E-D. S-E-E-D.
S-E-E-D.
Yep, so it is...
Okay. Seed phrase.
This is kind of off the air, so I'll explain to you now.
Yeah.
All right, when I want to generate this mathematical key pair, this public key and private key pair, I generate the private key. I do that using entropy. It's got to be random. This is what
entropy
makes security.
We
need randomness, which is entropy. Okay, we need a source of entropy. And we've tried everything from the reverse bias current on diodes to a video camera of a lava lamp. You know, there was a famous company used a number of lava lamps, and they had videos of video cameras recording the rise and fall of the oil conglomerations in them, mm-hmm. and they use that as a source of randomness for generating private keys. All right, it's too involved to get into now.
Okay,
but they generate this private key, and then using some mathematical processes, using those mathematical one-way trapdoors or one-way functions, we generate another big long number, and we're talking 30 digits long, 40 digits long, that matches that private key. But when we use that entropy to generate that private key, we need something that someone can recover it with. So they use a word list, and they randomly pick 24 words, in most cases, 24 words out of this big long list in a certain combination. And anytime I want to generate that private key again, I can put those words back into the software, and it will recreate exactly the same private key.
Oh, I see.
Does that make sense?
I didn't know that.
Yep.
Not really, but I'll take your word for it.
All right. So the guts of it is that seed phrase are the keys to the kingdom. Anyone that has the seed phrase can always generate the key pair again.
Okay.
All right. So the seed phrase is even more precious to you than the private key.
Right. Okay. And you always do a seed phrase, do you, when you set up one
always,
of these wallets?
Absolutely. Yes. Right. Yes. It's part of the process of creating the key pair, the private key.
Hmm.
So, and then you must record these, and the software that we use, depending on what cryptocurrency you're generating, to create the wallet, it won't let you create the key pair until you've written down and then fed back to the software that you've got the right words in the right order. That's how important they are. Okay, they are the keys to the kingdom. And a lot of people do things like they will take those words and they'll stamp them into a titanium plate, literally stamp them into a titanium plate and bury them in the ground somewhere. That's how important they are.
Mm.
Yeah, because with those words, you can always recreate the private key. Grant, my apologies. I've kind of made a bit of a hash of this because I didn't really prepare this to present to you today. But the guts of it is that we can create a public account number and a PIN number for using cryptocurrency, and you've got to keep control of that PIN number. That's the bottom line. So the technology was available. Satoshi Nakamoto wrote a protocol, and we can talk about different consensus things and so on later. But then we need an ecosystem for it to work. So we need computers all around the world to have copies of the blockchain.
Mm.
And then we need an interface for them so that we have some way of you and I, like, you have ATMs, you need to be able to access the banking system somehow. You can do it from your computer at home these days, or you can use it at an ATM with a card. So you need to have some sort of an interface to be able to get at that ecosystem of the blockchain. And the last step is the adoption, the widespread adoption. And so that's why when we think about the protocols were written for the banking system with credit cards and debit cards.
Right.
The technology was available. They wrote the protocols. They then produced the cards. They built the ecosystem. All the banks were connected together. They built the ATMs where you could take your card and withdraw cash. And then finally was the adoption phase. And we're only just even now getting started in the adoption phase of cryptocurrency. But I'm in no doubt whatsoever, it is the future of all financial transactions. The creation of the Internet of Value, I talked about earlier, we had the Internet of Information. The Internet of Value needed a couple of other problems to be solved. Kind of outlined roughly how that went, the double spend problem and the public key cryptography. That's all been done. It's been put into effect. The ecosystem has been built or is being built, and the interface, the user interface, is now available. There's lots of really easy apps, just like a banking app on your phone. I can access cryptocurrency using my phone, and so on. We'll talk about that a bit later as well, if you like. So all we need now is adoption. But there is no question in my mind that cryptocurrency absolutely is providing the internet parallel or analog of the old traditional financial transaction system, where we send funds or numbers from one place to another.
But aren't the banks and the governments working on a digital ID where they have their own currency within that?
Okay, the what digital would be the ID. Yep. Oh, we could talk about centralization, decentralization stuff later. Governments aren't stupid. Banks aren't stupid. They want to adopt, because of the efficiencies of cryptocurrency, in the same way that email is far more efficient, the World Wide Web is far more efficient than writing books. Email is far more efficient than writing letters and waiting for them to travel in boats and so on. Mm. So cryptocurrency is also the internet copy, but much faster, of a traditional transaction system. So all the people with an interest in that financial system being efficient, certainly they're all adopting cryptocurrency and blockchain. How they go about it, once again, come back to the fundamental principle that it is not the technology. The technology is agnostic when it comes to good or evil. Mm. It is the human hand that wields it. Now, the central bank digital currency, again, fundamentally, I don't see a problem with it, because it's just like cash, okay? The problem is when your identity is linked to that cash or that cryptocurrency system. So where the government can see and then intercede in what you do as an individual.
Mm, and
that
restrict you.
Very, very scary. Absolutely.
Restrict your freedoms.
That's what they call programmability, that they can decide what you could spend it on. So the idea of replacing the New Zealand dollar with a cryptocurrency system, I've no real problem with that. The problem I have is, because every cryptocurrency, be it a CBDC or otherwise, is completely transparent. I can look at any transaction at any point in time on a blockchain, and I can trace back through every transaction that ever existed to what they call the Genesis block, the very first block of that system. Okay, it's completely transparent. You can't hide anything on cryptocurrency. And this is one of the fallacies put about by, you know, people who are trying to stop you, scare people. Oh, well, it's, how do they say? It can be used for money laundering and child abuse or pornography and so on. That's no more the case for cryptocurrency than it is for cash.
Yeah.
Okay. Cryptocurrency is completely transparent. What we don't know is who controls the individual wallets. And that's what governments want to do. They want to control it. Whereas the principles of cryptocurrency, as espoused by Satoshi Nakamoto, was no, governments must not be allowed to interfere or know or program your currency.
So we really need to educate people like me on cryptocurrency and how to have a secure ledger, a secure wallet. We have our own private.
That stuff is simple. That's just done with a marketing campaign in the same way that they sold credit cards and debit cards to people. Mm. What we really need is to ensure the integrity of the people that are at the top of these chains. I don't mean the blockchain, but the people in government. That's the real problem. If the technology is available and it can be used good or bad, depending on your outlook, it's the people who are administering it that we really need to concern ourselves with. But yes, the current push by people that you and I both consider to be pretty inimical or malicious towards the general populace, they don't care about us, all they want is power and control.
Yeah.
They are using this system, they're instituting a system that will suit them, not necessarily us. So yes, we do need to be educated. How the cryptocurrency actually works doesn't really matter. It's just the internet copy of our current financial system, in the same way that you don't understand how email goes through SMTP or POP3 servers and so on. Yeah. You don't need to know that. So it's not about understanding the technology, it's understanding the implications of the application of the technology to our daily lives.
That's probably more what I mean. Okay. So if, say, I've got my wallet, it's a decentralized account. Is that what you call
it? Use Bitcoin if you like. We can talk about Bitcoin. It's not one that I use, but that's okay. Yeah, use Bitcoin as your example.
Any of those cryptocurrencies, you can whatever you think, hey. Like, they could go, they could crash. They're very volatile, aren't they? They go up and down.
Oh, they are. Well, that's because speculation. And again, you know, we talk about utility. You know, what gives something value? We said this earlier. It's something you can eat or sleep under, or you can use, or you can exchange with someone else because they want it. So it's got to have a use case. That's what makes things. And at the moment, we're in a speculative bubble, and we still are, have been for a decade or more, in cryptocurrency. That will change. The vast majority, 99.9% of cryptocurrencies will vanish. Most of them are scams. Most of them are leveraged. Absolutely. What are we trying to do with the cryptocurrency? We're trying to create a copy of the current financial system. But this time, we have the ability to do it on a global basis. We don't have to have a New Zealand dollar, an Australian dollar, a US dollar. We could have one cryptocurrency for the entire world. What's it got to be able to do? It's got to be fast. It's got to be safe, secure. It's got to be efficient and all that sort of stuff. Yeah. They're problems that may or may not have been solved yet. I've got some opinions on that again, an opinion on everything. But the fundamental is that the Internet of Value is here, and it depends on how it shakes out, how it evolves as to whether it's used for what we would call good or evil. Yeah, all right, Grant. Well, look, I think we've covered a fair bit of ground, and I'm
sure sorry
if your brain and your hair are on fire. I'd like to invite you, and anyone that's listening, if they've got questions about this, it's very easy for me to ramble on, but I'm sure that you have questions in your mind, and I'll bet that if you've got a question about this, then your listeners do as well, and I'd be more than happy to try and answer them. You know, if they could send you via your Podbean app and so on, send you the questions, and I'd like to be able to address those specifically, because this is an area of great interest, and it is the future, and I think it behooves all of us to be aware of it. So
I think you're right.
Again, thank you very much for our chat this morning. I very, very much enjoyed it, and I hope your head doesn't hurt too much.
It's great. Thanks, Omo. I look forward to see you next week. Have a great great time away with the lads.
See you soon.
Absolutely brilliant. Interesting, wasn't it? Hey, did you enjoy that? Now, if you've got a question, you give us a call here, and you leave a message. If I'm out working or doing something else, I'm away from the studio, give us a call on Wellington 04-889-0225. That's 04-889-0225, or email, which is libertynz@yandex.com. That's yandex.com. libertynz@yandex.com, or the mobile 04, not the mobile, or the phone number 04-889-0225. If you've got a question for Omo or for me or whatever you like, give us a call here at Liberty NZ. Love to hear from you.